Chariot Solutions TechCast, episode number 10 for Wednesday, May 28, 2008. This episode of the TechCast is sponsored by Drexel University's iSchool, the College of Information Science and Technology. Learn more at www.ischool.drexel.edu. On the show today, a keynote address by Lucinda Holt, CEO of Commerce 360, from the Chariot Emerging Technologies for the Enterprise Conference. Her presentation is entitled, Surfing on the Frothy Part of the Technology Wave. She discusses various waves or trends in technology adoption and how to use them to your business's advantage. You can find the presentation slides on our show notes page at www.chariotsolutions.com/podcasts/techcast/show notes.
And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's keynote speaker. Lucinda Holt is CEO of Commerce 360 and a former board member of Innovation Philadelphia. Commerce 360 is a venture capital-backed search marketing company that has developed Click Equation, the first search automation platform that provides integrated optimization. Lucinda is an accomplished technology CEO who has been involved in many startups throughout her career. In 2004, Lucinda co-founded and led Turntide, an anti-spam technology company which was acquired by Symantec for $28 million in 6 months. As an investor in Turntide before the buyout, Innovation Philadelphia was very happy with that quick turnaround and can't wait to the next one. Prior to founding Turntide, Lucinda was president and CEO of Destiny Web Solutions, a venture-backed company that provided internet strategy and implementation consulting to large financial institutions. While growing Destiny from $250,000 to $25 million in revenue, Lucinda received many honors. She was named America's 17th most influential consultant by Consulting Magazine, won the Eastern Technology Council's Enterprise Award for CEO of the Year, and was Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year. In addition to her CEO roles, Lucinda has been an entrepreneur in residence at First Round Capital and has held management positions at Infonautics, Automated Call Processing, SEI Investments, and American Express. She graduated cum laude from the University of Pennsylvania and earned an MBA from the Wharton School in Entrepreneurial Management. Today, Lucinda will kick off the conference with a presentation, Surfing on the Frothy Part of the Technology Wave. Please join me in welcoming Lucinda Holt.
Thank you, Kelly. Am I on? Hope I'm on. Let's get this back. Okay. Am I too loud? Thank you. So as I mentioned to a couple of people that I ran into before this, it's been a while, honestly, since I've been nervous giving a talk. I give a fair amount of this, but this crowd makes me a little nervous. First of all, there's more folks out there who I know and haven't seen in years, which is totally wonderful, but it makes me want to do a really, really great job. And you know, one of the few regrets I have in my career is I really look back and I wish that I'd had a technology undergraduate degree. I think I really should have started life as a developer, but instead I was a liberal arts candidate. I have two daughters, the older of whom is 7, who is programming in Python now, so just to make sure that she doesn't end up with the same problem that I had. So I thought, you know, Tracy first called and we talked about whether I'd do this, and I was sort of overwhelmingly flattered because my first thing was sort of, yeah, that'd be great, but what do I have to say to this crowd? I don't know what I normally sort of get up and do a shtick about all the companies I've been involved in and sort of the stories, and it can be pretty entertaining, but it's not necessarily real value add. And so we talked through topics and ended up with this topic of surfing technology waves. And so what I'm gonna do today is present to you two models that I've learned and applied consistently through my career that help you add context in terms of how to make technology decisions. Now, when I make technology decisions, it's typically at this point, should we found a company? Should we form a company? Is this a wave that will support a company? What do we think about the dynamics of it? But I think that the models that I'll walk you through today are also applicable to, we're building a product, we're building an internal system, we're building whatever it is. How do you back up a step, take a longer view, and I hope add some value by adding context to those decisions, therefore making them better decisions. So what I'm going to do is there's two models. I'm going to talk through one in the frame of actual technology businesses. So businesses who make money by selling technology. Second of all, I'll talk about a model that applies to technology-enabled businesses. That is, you're an insurance company or something and you need systems to make your business work. In truth, each model is applicable to the other, but it was a nice way to sort of break down the talk. And with each one of those models, I'm going to walk through some very specific examples from my career, how they worked, and in some cases, candidly, how they didn't work. And then after that, I'll have a brief third part of the talk, which is sort of a couple points that apply to both worlds. Within each one of those, I'll give some summary lessons learned as well. My goal is to do this slightly less than the allotted time, so if anybody has anything you want to talk about, we'll have some time to do that. So please be thinking about that as we go along, otherwise it'll be really awkward and I'll just be standing up here and no one will have any ideas. So Kelly gave you a brief sort of background. She gave you the Cliff Notes version of the background. I'm going to give you very briefly first just a little bit of a timeline because I use all these examples in the talk. So I started out of college here and worked at a San Francisco-based startup called First Dial Info and then Automated Call Processing for 4 years as essentially a product manager. And then I went back to school and then I spent the only time I've ever spent in a larger organization. Spent 5 years at SEI Investments, which is a local technology and investment management company. And then I went to an internet company in 95 called Infonautics as a product manager, and then came to Destiny with Skip, who's out there somewhere. There's a whole bunch of Destiny people here today, which is great to see. Did that, then did Turntide, which I'll talk about that example in some depth. Co-founded a company that I won't talk about called Cut, very brief. And then we've been doing Commerce 360 now for a couple of years. So if you look at all that, I've run, depending, and in there I was an interim CEO of a couple companies and all that, depending on how you look at it, I've run 3 or 5 startup technology companies. I've worked in 2 others. I've been on the board of I don't know how many. I founded 2 of them. And I was, as Kelly mentioned, an entrepreneur in residence at First Round Capital where I saw over 100 companies. So what you're seeing here is basically abstraction of a lot of mostly painful lessons. So let's start this story about technology. The first thing, as I said, is the key is to think about this in a broader context. It's very, very easy to get into, especially candidly when you're an engineer, isn't this cool? Wouldn't it be cool if? Here's this neat thing. One of the things I hope that these models empower you to do is to sort of stop that and step back. And when those decisions are right, go for it, but have the context for how you're making it. Essentially, what we're trying to do here is increase the odds that you're making the right bet. Doesn't mean you're going to be sure, right? We're always at these frothy waves. You don't know what's really going to work. But hopefully, using these models, you can increase the bet, the likelihood of the bet. At a minimum, though, you should have a better sense of how likely is it that you're right. So often, we have to make a decision even though you really don't know. But it's important to know when you're making the decision, I really don't know, but I'm making this decision versus we're absolutely sure, because you should react differently once you're inside it. And then lastly, and this will come into the third point, which is more across the board and how you build businesses, is you need to manage the business you're running in a way that's consistent with the stage of the maturity of the technology that you're in. And so what we'll do is enable you to tell that. So we're going to walk through these two, technology-driven, technology-enabled. The common theme across this is that technology, and therefore the businesses that you build on technology, and that's right. That's the big difference here is that I don't really get to build any technology, unfortunately. I just ride these waves. They do develop in waves, and the waves are actually very predictable. Some of them take longer times periods of time. Some of them are shorter, some of them are bigger, some of them are smaller. But there are very, very consistent cycles. And once you back out and you can see the consistent cycles, then you have the opportunity to use that data to figure out which one to get on at what time. Now, as I said, I do think that this way of thinking is important to really almost any base technology decision. So even if you're in a big company, these things are really important. But when you're in the startup world where I play, these decisions literally are life and death. If you make these bets right, you'll have lots of room for error. You'll have lots of power behind you, even if you're not executing well. There'll be lots of smaller waves, the auxiliary waves that come off of a main wave. So, for example, I'm going to talk about an example in the telephone network world. I was around, believe it or not, when we switched from rotary to touchtones. We went from analog to digital phone lines. That was a massive wave. Dozens of waves, right, came out as a result of that. So there's a flexibility that big waves afford you when you can view them this way. And for startups, that is literally life and death. And why am I not forwarding? So let's start by talking about technology-driven waves. In 1997. I was a freshly minted first-time CEO, didn't know a damn thing about anything, and I was at a venture capital conference in Atlanta, Venture South, Red Herring's Venture South. I'm not still to this day quite sure how a Philadelphia company qualified for Venture South. I think to get decent companies, they had to raise the Mason-Dixon lineup. And at lunch, I bumped into this guy, Bob Davoli. Bob Davoli is an amazing guy. He started his career, believe it or not, as a folk singer. He was then a nanny, became, through his very kind of convoluted path, the CEO of a consulting company that did extremely well, did that a second time, ultimately became a venture capitalist at a firm called Sigma Partners, which is a Silicon Valley, Boston firm. He's a multi-billionaire at this point, having started as a folk singer. That's a little unusual for an outcome. He's one of the smartest guys I've ever met. About this sort of thing. He's also a very snappy dresser. That's an extremely conservative outfit for him. When he first came to visit us at Destiny in 97, those of you who were around will remember, he showed up in this suit with purple pinstripes. It's a loud thing, and he's a little tiny sort of man. He's about 5'6" and very, very slight. So Bob came to visit us. And ultimately did not invest in Destiny. I'll talk about that, although I saw him about a month ago, still maintain a relationship with him. He came and outlined, among other things, shared with us a model. And this is the first model that I'm going to show. This one is not available sort of academically. He actually worked with some guys at Harvard on it, but they didn't ever publish it. It is the single most sort of compelling model I've ever seen for this. So what you have is market size. So we're not talking about just technology adoption or penetration or something. This is about actually building businesses and technology. Then you've got time. Bob will tell you that the first thing that happens in any technology market is you get the application of that technology in custom ways. So you get things like technologies embedded in very specialized, you know, medical equipment products. Typically, the early implementations are really expensive, so stuff in NASA, and there's all sorts of ways this happens. And then you start to build up this curve. Prices drop, right? The technology becomes more widely understood, we're more widely known. You begin to get sort of tools, you begin to get forums and talks about it, and it begins to spread, and that custom curve goes crazy. Now, from a business standpoint, what's happening here is some companies, typically technology-enabled companies, are making money by using the technology in their products, and consulting companies are making money here, right? So they're because the expertise is valuable and tight, people go to consulting firms at this point in the curve. Now, the next curve that develops is tools. The tool curve is typically the responsibility of folks who are in this room. typically what happens is developers, so if we're focused on software products, developers who are doing this app, these systems get really sick of having to do the same dumb things over and over again, so they build tools. Right, sort of fundamental in most developers' makeup is they'd much rather solve the problem once than have to keep doing it over and over again, so they build tools. If you notice, that curve never gets that big. It does stay around because folks sort of need the tools forever. The challenge with it as a business is not only does a wave never really get that big, because unfortunately developers aren't really the best crew in the world to sell stuff to. The other problem is there's 8,000 of them because everybody does it. So it doesn't tend to be a very good market for startups because it's very fragmented and not a lot of dollars as you move along. The next wave is the monster wave. The next wave is the one where most startups make money. And that's the application. So now you have not a thing that's got it done custom. Now you have the actual embodiment of the innovation in products. And typically what you'll see if we stick to software, although this model works for pretty much any kind of disruptive technology, and I should have said that, both of these models really apply only to disruptive technologies. Here you can have applications in all kinds of vertical markets. You can have applications at all sorts of levels. So you'll get a bunch of companies that will do extremely, extremely well. They tend to sell super fast because you've solved the problem by then, right? For the first two stages of this curve, really what you're talking about is potential, right? And it's painful. There's no training classes in books, and there's not places to go. There's no libraries yet. There's all this stuff. Now you're getting to where you're seeing huge business value created, and startup companies will do really well. And then the last phase, that doesn't always happen, but almost always does, is you'll get the markets unify around platforms. Platforms for the winners are extraordinary businesses, right? This is when, you're Windows. Who wouldn't want to be, I wouldn't want to be Windows, but take the money if I didn't have to use the software. The challenge with platforms from a startup standpoint is incredibly difficult to predict who's going to win that. It's the result of so many things that you have no control over. Certainly adoption is part of it and that can help, but very, very difficult to predict. So whereas you've got the applications where many people can win big in all sorts of ways, the platforms, you'll typically only get one or two, depending on how big a market we're talking about, how dispersed and all the rest, and maybe more, but within a given segment, you're typically only talking about one or two. Doesn't tend to be the best place, therefore, to focus your efforts as a startup, and is, I would say, candidly, a mistake a lot of technology founders make is going after that. Because it's almost like a tool on steroids in that it solves the problem, right? And who doesn't want to be sort of in the middle of the grand unifying theme that solves the problem? You want to do that. It's just very, very difficult to get there, very dependent on all the other dynamics in the market. So that's the Divoli model, and we'll apply it now to a number of examples. But first, how do we know whether we're on the right wave? So now you've got the sense of how these markets develop. Very, very basic chart that we're going to use a couple times through this. But it bears repeating, I think, because I think we fail to think this way often. And I will admit to falling into this, it's cool trap as well, because I kind of like this stuff too. But essentially, if you think you've got risk and reward in any technology decision, almost any business decision there is, and any rational person would make the decision to stay to the north of that line, right? And the blue line is where the risk and reward are sort of even out. Above the line is where you've got more reward than risk, and below the line is where you have more risk than reward. Why go there, right? Well, think back in your career. I guarantee you can come up with three times that you were involved in situations where folks made decisions where you were below that line. So that's a base sort of recurring theme. As a technology-based startup, you really want just a couple really straightforward things in one of these waves. You want one that is really, really big. The bigger, the better. Humongous. And I think a lot of folks think about that backwards. They think you're too big. You have to match the wave. You want a little wave because you're little, right? Total opposite. You want a big wave that that's super fast moving and is really, really early. I've been involved in a bunch of these. Some of the best, we were early in the application server market, although we blew that one. I'll talk through that example. We then, at Destiny, leveraged the web development. We got on that custom curve, but it was absolutely an enormous wave, very early. Anti-spam was an extremely compacted one of these. And today, online marketing, I'll show you some of the numbers, is the same thing. So what you're looking for, and I'll talk through why in a second, is really big, really fast, really early. This is what Sequoia, the number one venture capital firm in the world, says. You want to address existing markets, poised for rapid growth or change, market on the path to $1 billion, potential allows for error and time for real margins to develop. So this is the why. You want something big because the fast moving essentially keeps the big guys away. That terrifies them. Big guys understand they're not agile, so they get on a path and they realize that they can't get off that path. And these waves are difficult in micro to predict where they're going to go, so they're uncomfortable there. So you get some time in that early wave, and you're going to be wrong. I'm going to show you some statistics in a minute about it. I guarantee you're going to be wrong. So you want a nice, big, long time to have space to fix it. You want to be able to surf the wave back and forth. Now, there are downsides of big waves, right? The main one is that they tend to be crowded. You know, depending on how you look at it, paid search management has something like 500 competitors right now. Well, the reality is Commerce 360 is working on an auxiliary wave that has 10 of us on it. So you can cut these markets, and you can cut these markets in ways that sort of skinny them down. Regardless, even when they're crowded, the size of the opportunity, the flexibility in terms of both space and time that you get is really worth the trade-off. So how do you know which one? How do you know what to look for? Well, there's a reason we use this analogy. Waves just keep coming. Well, if you think back to the Tivoli model, if you're going to be a consulting company, this is a really, really easy thing to do, because as a consulting company, basically what you do is you listen for what customers ask you for, and then you deliver what they ask you for. You know, it's not like software development where you have to make the bet a year ahead and try to assess where the market's going to be. You just get the phone call, you answer, you got to find the folks who know whatever the thing is they want, and you go find some of those people. If you have to, you train them, you do whatever you have to do. Well, so that's how you sort of play the custom. You're not playing the custom wave, and that's really not, although I did do it once, not my thing. Sort of the obvious thing, which so few people do, is just look. You want to know about the application? Look at what's going on in custom. And just figure out what an application of it would be. And then you got to make the bet from there. So what you do is essentially look at the curves that are naturally going to happen ahead of you to get to the next one. So I mentioned the touchtone phone thing. It was really pretty obvious that touchtone was going to be huge, and this was, when was this, 85, so waves actually moved a little slower back then. It was less fun, a little easier to play. I'm going to walk you through an example of an amazingly successful company called Dial Info. I joined Dial Info right out of college, a San Francisco-based startup. It was founded by an amazing entrepreneur named Ken Jones. Ken had made money, and he mostly, this was backed by himself and the chairman, he'd made money, believe it or not, meatpacking business in Chicago before he did this. He was a Kellogg MBA who went to do meatpacking. And essentially what they figured was there was going to be these new touchtone telephones everywhere. The touchtone phone was going to become an interface to the computer. So it voice response applications. Now the obvious one that 98% of the folks, the entrepreneurs were chasing at that time was voicemail. It was actually harder to think, what would you do with this? Now it's sort of obvious, you do everything with it, but before it happened, it's never quite as obvious. So they developed, he and another technical co-founder developed proprietary hardware and software to recognize the touchtone rings and then build specialized applications on top of it. And the question was, you know, there really wasn't at that point a market for a core technology that enabled you to do voice response. Because the only people who even knew the thing existed were geeks, and the truth was 3/4 of the market didn't have them yet, didn't have touch tones, so what did you do? These guys did something really smart. They looked into the future and basically built their own consumer-facing business based on the platform. And at the time, it was the 976 numbers, 50 cents a phone call. I don't know how people, just sort of the precursor to 1-900 numbers. Before it was slimy, there were all kinds of services like get the lottery results. The one that we had that was my total favorite, this is what I did right out of college, this is Gene Dixon. For those of you with gray hair in the room, you remember Gene Dixon was Nancy Reagan's astrologer. This was back in those wonderful days when the White House schedule was set by an astrologer. Maybe it worked better. So they basically took a core technology. We took a core technology and built a custom on it ourselves, all the way to the end user. Even though that's what we were doing, the point was always the core technology, which turned out to be an awfully good thing because this business got really slimy really fast. And I think everyone knows where this went. But what we were able to do is, we'll talk about agility a lot, is take that core technology where we build custom, and because we had a bunch of developers, we built a set of tools that made it easier to create these custom applications, and so we shifted. And we built an application that enabled advertising and PR firms to build large volume inbound phone promotions. So I was out there in San Francisco as a little account manager running around to Ketchum Communications, which had clients including the California Raisins and Kool-Aid, and talking them into using interactive voice response for promotions for their clients. So we did things like we enabled entry to the Pillsbury Bake Off using our platform. You could call and check your Kool-Aid Club points online using your touchtone cell phone, just a touchtone phone, and just to give folks, especially there's a lot of young people here, I used to have to carry a little touchtone generator around with me because you'd go in most offices and the phones were still rotary dial, and so you'd do the touchtones through the phone. So very successful wave surfing from custom over into the application space. Ultimately, this company was acquired by MCI and became a platform. So MCI acquired the company, and literally, if you wanted to do an interactive voice response application, which by that time, we're in like 90, I guess, we were acquired, they were everywhere, and everybody wanted to do them, and it was a value-added service that MCI could sell. So a rare case of setting out to want to be a platform, surfing through all these waves, and ultimately getting there. And I forgot I had the slide that showed it to you with these cool animations. So we started doing the custom, built tools, applications, and ultimately hit the platform. I think that when you look at this example, and I thought actually a lot about this, especially when I was at school, why were we able to do that? I think one of the really critical things here was this wave was just so big, right? It was mandated by the government. This was happening all at the same time. AT&T was breaking up, so there was a natural pace to the wave. It was just really, really much more controlled than you see today, right? This thing took 10 years to play out. This today in the internet space would take a year and a half or 2 years probably. It would be much, much more difficult. So although it's a great example because it shows each piece, it's not one I would suggest entrepreneurs try to follow. Another one that I would not suggest entrepreneurs try to follow, thankfully that's not me, is the first generation of what happened at Destiny. So I'll tell the Destiny story for those of you who didn't actually work there. Destiny, when I joined, had been around for a couple years, was an amazing little company. I joined in December of 96, and there were two employees at that point. It was in a basement in Elverson, Pennsylvania. If anybody knows where Elverson is, it doesn't really matter if you know where it is in the middle of nowhere, nobody knows where it is. And they had a really extraordinary client list. First sort of consulting client had been Vanguard, and the current client was Bank of America. And the company was building online transaction systems. It was 1996 online transaction systems, not brochureware, actual systems where consumers could go and get their statements and actually move money and pay bills and all the rest. We built the first systems at Vanguard, AOL, First USA, and then moved to the web for those same organizations. So there was this amazing client list. And we had this technology called Granite Foundation, which was essentially, in retrospect, an application server that was tuned for financial services. So it had all sorts of security and login features. It had account things. There's all sorts of things that are common to financial services systems that weren't otherwise. When we started there, we got $1 million in venture capital in 97, which at that time was actually a lot of money. Now that's not that much money, but at that time that was a big venture capital first round. Went around hiring people and built these systems. And I'll never forget, this goes back to Bob Davoli. We were sometime in the spring of 97, Skip and I, who's here somewhere, we're up at Bob's office meeting with his geekier partner, John. And we're sitting there, and John says, after Skip walks through the whole story, well, isn't this just an application server? And I'll never forget it. I literally have this visceral memory of writing down on my pad of paper, application server, ? We weren't thinking about the world that way. And unfortunately, it was what we had. But when you look at what had happened in that market, it was this unbelievable ramp up this application wave there. It just happened so fast. And here we were with our $1 million and some technologies and great clients, but we weren't really productized because we were doing all the integration of the system ourselves, and we were just basically caught behind. So we did what any good entrepreneur would do, and we got creative. We did a duck dive. We said, time to switch waves. We looked a long time for another product wave that we liked, couldn't find one, so we switched. So we switched from the application curve up to the consulting curve. Now to the custom curve. Now, it was tremendously successful. If you look at the, from a revenue perspective, when you looked at the revenue, we were doing about 2.4, I think it was, we went to 2.3, 6.4, 12.1, 18.25. From a revenue perspective, it was unbelievably successful because we switched from this very competitive application market to this wide open web development custom world. The challenge is on the custom wave, right, tons of people were doing it, so you're not very differentiated. And because you don't have to make all the investment in the bet and all the rest of that, the challenge is the companies aren't worth very much. So the same company, so it's easier in a sense to build business on the custom wave because of the nature that you just wait for someone to ask and then you give it to them. The challenge is if you take two businesses, one software and one consulting business, and they each have $10 million in revenue and $1 million in profit, that software company is worth somewhere between 5 and 10 times as much as the custom company is. So it's easier, but guess what? It's not worth as much. So, given where we were at Destiny, it was a great shift because we had a business, and it was a real business, and at one point, before we got pounded by the bubble and then 9/11, it was worth something. But at the end of the day, it's never quite as good a place to be. So that's a case where we didn't get it quite right. And next came the story, which Kelly alluded to, where we did. So in 2003, 2004, spam was an amazing place. As Josh Koppelman, our founding investor, likes to say, end of 2003, early 2004, you could walk into literally any room anywhere in the United States and say, who's got a problem with spam? And every single hand went up. It was monstrously painful. When you talk to network admins, they were just being pounded. People couldn't add servers fast enough to their mail infrastructure. It was just a complete nightmare. And here we were at Turntide with the only time in my career, and sort of an unusual case, we had a really, truly, genuinely better solution. It was completely differentiated and 100% better. The solution, essentially, when you think about how spam, anti-spam products work, pretty much all the others, not all, and pretty much all the others, are filters. So the software accepts the messages, it looks at the messages, it decides whether each message is spam or good mail. If it's good mail, it sends it along to you, and if it's bad, if it's spam, it quarantines it. Right? So it's, and they've got to get, therefore, they have to get every single message right. We just turned on about a month ago our Commerce 360, our email provider's spam service, I forget which it is, and it literally so far for me has 100% false negatives. Every single message that it has quarantined was a good message. And although it's kind of handy to have all my newsletters over there in the quarantine, I'd really rather sort of have them where I wanted them, that was the state of affairs. And none of that, if you notice, doesn't prevent your network from getting pounded. Of course, people could outsource it completely, which is one of the key drivers for people to outsource mail, all this spam. The way Turntide worked was just fundamentally different. And there's some Turntide guys here too. Toby's here. I don't see Dave, but I know he's talking here. Those are the guys who invented the technology. Turntide solved the problem at the network layer. It was the world's first anti-spam router. So what we did instead, completely innovative, was we sat in line, passed messages right through, never stopped a message, passed them right through. As they went through, we looked at each message and assessed how likely it was that it was spam. So note, we don't have to get it right 100% of the time because the messages went through. What we do then is sum essentially the probabilities that each message is spam to assess how probable it is that a sender is spamming. Once we know that a sender is spamming, we would just tighten down their access to our network. We essentially traffic shape it. So if you were sending lots of good mail, you were wide open, you could come flying through. If you looked like you were sending spam, we only gave you a little tiny window. That in of itself dropped spam by about 90%. Not just the spam, right? Literally took the load off the network. It literally couldn't get into the network. Then they had this wonderful secondary effect, which frankly we didn't really predict. It just happened. It was this wonderful cherry on top. Is that spam cannons, the software that spammers use to send spam, is programmed, so those guys are smart, they may be slimy, but they're smart, is programmed to abandon slow connections. Because why would I waste my time and money sending spam at a slow connection? So what happened? They just abandoned Turntide protected networks. They just stopped sending spam. So literally, it just would go away. We would have 99% plus elimination of spam within the first month. It was an amazing experience. This enabled us to sell like crazy. Within the first 6 months, we had signed Edward Jones. This is a brand new baby tiny company. Edward Jones Brokerage, PricewaterhouseCoopers Global, Drexel, Penn, and I can't, a whole array of huge enterprise clients. We just got it dead right. And I'll tell you, there is nothing, absolutely nothing like the experience of riding a wave like that. It is a complete flow. It is so much fun. It is so much work, but it is so much fun. You're having this positive impact on the world. You're being successful. Your clients are great. It was just absolutely an amazing experience. And the results, the payoff, showed it. So in January, we founded the company with $700,000 in funding, plus the technology, the base technology, came in from another company. And in July, my thing would go, we sold it for $28 million. Just unbelievable experience. And happily, in this kind of case, the other thing that was great is we had 4 salespeople who were doing great, but now there's 2,000 salespeople out there trying to make the world safe against spam. Well, it's a more complicated story, actually. What happens when Symantec got the technology? You can ask Toby about it. I just had to use this graphic. I found this on Google Images. Isn't that great? So if we summarize from these experiences, we've got a paradigm. We've walked through some examples. Now just let me summarize with a couple lessons learned. First of all, the wave. This is the market that Commerce 360 is addressing. You can see by 2011, it's projected to be a $60 billion market. That is an enormous market. If you look at the compound annual growth rates, we found in 2006, it was 63% on a $15 billion market. Amazing numbers. This is basically where What the market I'm talking about here is paid search advertising. So this is the right-hand side and now the top of Google. This is where all of Google's, 99% of Google's revenue comes from, growing just insanely. So it's this massive wave. It's creating these wavelets underneath it. So as I mentioned earlier, there's about 500 companies that help advertisers place this. The overwhelming majority of them, back to our Tivoli curve, are custom. They're agencies. In that world, consulting firms are called agencies, right? What we're doing is we're very, very early. There's about 10 competitors in the market for building software to optimize this stuff, which is, if you learn a little bit about it, just painfully obvious that it ought to be software. So fast-growing market, big wave, fast, and it's early, just like we talked about. That's why we're there. One layer deeper, why is it that these big waves work? Yes, they give, as I said earlier, they give you more time to move around, et cetera. But specifically, there's three things about the interplay between big and small that are fundamentally different in these early market, big market phases, and that play to the little guy's advantage, as our little guys here band together to eat the bigger fish. The first one is that at this point in time, big companies will buy from small players. Very unusual, right? Later on, they just won't. But at the beginning, they don't really have an option, A, and B, you'll get folks who are early on the curve who see some competitive advantage potentially, and you can get the bet. And for small companies, big clients are really important. It's very difficult to go up market. It's very difficult to start with little clients and move your way up. It's the natural thing everyone wants to try to do. Nearly impossible. When you start with small clients, you're going to be stuck with small clients. But if you can start with big clients, you can always trickle down. So in these early markets, you can get the big clients. The second one is that you can have an impact on how the ecosystem develops. Once you're later, you're just subject to it. But early on, you can be on standards boards. You can run the forum. You can be the ones that host the conference. You can write the books. You can establish the APIs. You can, all these things you can actually have an impact on early, which allow you to sort of meld the market to go a little bit in your direction. And then lastly, and maybe most importantly for venture-backed startups, because kind of part of our goals, we got to make money for our investors, is big companies buy small companies in these kind of markets. Because they can't play there themselves. They can't do the innovation themselves. They know that. So they just wait, see which one of the small companies is going to be successful, and then buy them. So it's really the one time when small has an advantage over big, presuming that you can stay agile. And it really is all about agility. Big guys have a lot of advantages. Our aircraft carrier has deep pockets. They have existing customers they can sell to. They're perceived as the safe option by their prospects. And they have all kinds of leverage with other people, other vendors and partners and all the rest that you don't have. But they've got inertia. That bad boy cannot turn around. Our little guys down front, those are us, can turn around in a 60-foot radius and be going the other direction once the market changes. So you have to stay agile. And agility is really only one thing. Agility is about people, right? Yes, it's true you can get your burn rate up or make a big contract or something that sort of gets you stuck on a path, but generally it's about people. And if you look at what we did at Dial Info, what we did at Destiny, it was the flexibility of the individuals in total that allowed us to make those changes successfully. And if you look at it, it's not just sort of me talking. Here's some actual numbers from a great venture capitalist in New York named Fred Wilson at Union Square Ventures. He took the 26 deals where he's exited or lost his money to date. He's a very well-known, very successful venture capitalist. And he looked at how many of them transformed their business between when he invested and that end, whatever the ending was, and how many of them persisted in their same business model. As you can see, the home runs, those are deals that returned better than 5x his money. 7 transformed, 4 persisted. The hits, that was 1 to 5x his money, 6 and 4. But the killer is, of the 5 that failed in white, 4 stuck it out and 1 transformed. Can this possibly make less sense? So here you are, you're failing, you absolutely are going under, and yet you're sticking to the plan. It's just about where your headspace is. And here's sort of examples of numbers to prove it. When you talk anecdotally to anybody who plays in this market, they'll tell you the one thing you know about a startup is it's not going to end where it started up. So that's that model. We're going to shift now and talk a little bit more succinctly through a second model. Summary on this one, right, is think it through in context. How do these waves develop? Where are you? How safe? Where are you on the risk-reward continuum? And make the right bet. Switching gears to tech-enabled, I'm going to use here a very well-known market, very well-known model, and that is Geoffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm. It's more of a marketing model than it is a how technologies develop, which is why I'm going to talk about a little bit more with tech-enabled products, but again, they both work really for both. The concept is that markets start with enthusiasts. Enthusiasts are, looking for graphics for this, and I found one that said, described enthusiasts as the kind of people who put their hand in the microwave just to see what it's like. These are the people who just love technology, want to pull it apart, want the thing that's brand new, they want to know about it before anybody else. If it's not painful, it can't be interesting enough. Very, very early guys. Next come the visionaries. Visionaries are much more interested in outcome. They will take huge risks. They don't care whether all the infrastructure is there. These guys are the lifeblood of a startup. You need some of those enthusiasts, because the enthusiasts are usually where visionaries go to learn about you. But the enthusiasts are kind of wacky. They're not going to do a lot. These visionaries are your early buyers who see some huge competitive advantage you're going to offer. They're the ones who are going to be your beta customers, because they want input in terms of how that product is developed. These guys are absolutely critical. They're critical to understand. They're a personality type. They're actually, you have to think about these as individuals, right? They do tend to be companies. So, in financial services, Capital One and Fidelity Investments are known to house these kind of people. They do beta software that nobody else on earth would. At Commerce 360, we're working right now with American Express, just astounding, one of the biggest programs in the world. I think they're the fourth largest, or something. It's massive, seventh largest online budget in the world. Will take a bet on somebody like us because of this, because they're looking for some completely catapulting advantage. Then you have, in Geoffrey's model, the chasm, it's not really the focus of this today, but the idea is there's now discontinuous change in the prospect base. This kind over on the left will take pain, they're looking for huge gain. The pragmatists follow. The pragmatists are early adopters, but they want all the stuff there. They want the documentation. They want the references. They want an ROI that you can show them. They're not buying on faith. These first guys will buy on faith that it's got to make strategic sense, but they're just going to go. These guys want numbers from someone who did it before. And then you have the rest of the model, which is sort of irrelevant to us. That's where the big guys play, the conservatives and the skeptics. So I'll walk you through one example here. SEI investments. When I joined right out of business school, I was a product manager in 401k market. And 401k has a bunch of elements. Part of it is employee education. So a big issue is people don't invest their money properly. Young people tend to invest their money too conservatively. They don't really understand how risk and reward play over time, variability and all that. So we built a product, a little desktop thing, that was a little calculator that was very cool. It was very graphical, that allowed people to put in, what age you're going to retire and how you invested and all the rest of this stuff. The big decision from a product management standpoint was, what platform are we going to build on? Right? So this thing had to be disseminated all over the place with employers, mostly in HR offices. We're 1991 at this point. And at the time, you see MS-DOS just came out. Windows 3.0, for those of you who are too young to remember, was the first real Windows. 3.1 was even more so. And this has got to be a graphical thing. So it seemed obvious that that's what we would build on, the latest stuff. Unfortunately, the target market didn't have PCs that would even run any of that. So we made a decision to build on PC DOS 3.2. We had to go at least to 3.2 because we needed the 3.5-inch floppy drives, the 720K ones. That was the first time. So literally, we picked knowingly a 6-year-old technology platform to build the product on, and it was outrageously successful. When you look at where we stood, very low risk. This thing had been around forever. We totally knew it would work. very high reward because we were matching the technology decision with the need. Those guys were late. They had slow stuff. They didn't care if we could have built the thing in a green screen if we'd been able to. And surprisingly, the technology constraints, I actually went back to the dev team, and like all great products, literally we're still all in touch with each other. Here we are 16 years later. Nobody has a copy of this stupid software program. It's great. You would look fresh today. It was totally graphical. The developer did an amazing job on it. So there's a case where I made a good decision. The same product unit, you have at 401k, you need what's called a record keeping system, which is the big monolithic system, extraordinarily complex. It is literally one of the most complex financial systems around, much more complex than trading systems and all the rest, believe it or not, which tracks your 401k account. When did the payroll come in? How much? How is it split? How are your investments growing? How are those growing versus others? What's vested? What's unvested? What loan came out? When did you move money where? Where was your IRA rollover? All this sort of stuff. So we had to build this record-keeping system. When I joined, development had been underway for about 3 years. And it was a client server. We'd had a mainframe system. This was the first client server build. And they had made a decision to build this client on OS 2. So we were many millions of dollars into development at this point. The year before I joined, I'm pretty sure it was 90, IBM and Microsoft fell out of bed over OS 2. That was probably the death knell for the system. So here we sat. The reason that it had been picked was that you could do all this cool graphical stuff. You know, you could Windows and all these kind of things, which you couldn't do at that time in any other. And you got in this hole. We had gotten in this hole, wouldn't it be cool if? Wouldn't it be cool if? Unfortunately, in this case, my clicker's not working, we rolled craps. Ultimately, we closed it down. We made a technology bet that all this graphical stuff was going to be really cool. At the same time that we were moving forward with this, there were all kinds of studies and press reports showing that operators were actually faster with tabbing through green screens. The mouse just slowed everybody down. Clearly, ultimately the support for OS 2 dried up. So we'd made this decision for all this cool stuff that didn't end up mattering in the market, and we built on a platform that ended up not going anywhere. So if you look at our risk-reward continuum again, we were exactly where you do not want to be. We had taken a lot of technical risk. It had been extremely slow and expensive to build because we were right on the bleeding edge, and we'd basically gotten nothing for it. So you get the same lesson out of those two examples. You want to match the technology to the need, and I obviously picked examples where leading edge stuff was a bad match, old stuff was a good match. I'm not at all advocating that, right? Where I play every day, we're like out past bleeding edge making those bets, but you really have to get the logic of it right. Often the sweet spot for this stuff, when you're tech-enabled, again, when you're not selling the core technology, but where your business is tech-enabled, like this one was, is to be a pragmatist. So to be in that second wave, you're an early adopter, so you get some of the competitive advantage because most folks are conservative and late, so you're better off than many other people, yet there's an ecosystem, right? There's places you can go, there's people you can see, it's not impossible to find developers, all the tools are in place, you got the books, you got the courses, really not a bad place to be. Unfortunately, if you're a developer, maybe not the most fun place to be, but really in a tech-enabled business, almost, not, I would say at least a majority of the time, it's the right place to be. So this lesson for the second set of paradigms is if there's real strategic value, move early. I don't have an example here, but there's absolutely many of them where you get huge advantages for moving early. Technology enthusiast phase is, you know, generally too early for anybody who's building anything. That should be, you know, for your side projects. You can get significant advantage out of being a visionary. It's a bet, so you just have to take your odds and realize you may be right, you may be wrong. So those are the two models, the Davoli model, the Jeffrey Moore model. Now I'm going to talk about one point that I think is really, really critical that applies to both. And it's oft said, but it nonetheless bears repeating, plus it lets me play video for a second and drink some water, and that is that the best technology does not win.
It's going to load in the appropriate drivers. You'll notice that this scanner build,
Bill says that's why we weren't shipping Windows 98 yet. I mean, it's easy to pick on Microsoft, but the reality is, you know, the quality of the business.
That must be why we're not shipping Windows 98.
Absolutely.
The blue screen of death is real, right? But it doesn't sort of matter at the end of the day because everything around it is so powerful. The ecosystem, how are you gonna pull it out? You know, we're a heterogeneous shop at Commerce 360. Our account people, it's virtually impossible to put them on Macs because the entire world that they interact with is on Windows, and there's all kinds of mishmash and problems. We don't want to create problems for our clients. We'd rather deal with those problems internally. So the power of the ecosystem and understanding where you are is really important. And at the end of the day, the marketing thing is really the most important. And that is targeting the right message to the right audience. And happily, the waves that I just walked through help with this too. Not that we've got a lot of marketers in the room, but essentially, if you understand where your market is, you can match your message to your market. So today at Commerce 360, the agency business is already pretty mature, right? There's 500 of them, people use them already. The software business, however, is brand new, totally different kind of prospect. And we have to figure out how to message to each one of these audiences, which really are completely different. So the summary is, your goal is to hit the right wave at the right time with the right message, targeted at the right people. If you do that, your probability of success in either business goes up tremendously. So that's the academic content. I want to just put on one coda, because when you look at the world this way and it looks sort of dispassionate, that's not really what it's like. You know, what I do every day, we're living right at the edge of these markets, in these frothy parts of these waves. It's tremendously exciting. What it means is that every single thing that every single person does in these companies every day matters. And so having this context can help you make better decisions, but even more importantly, it makes you more successful. It makes the whole thing much, much more fun. What you're looking for is to experience the alchemy hour. And happily, as I showed at Turntide, when this happens, you can make money by doing it. And my five-second advertisement, if you're core, you know, if big, exciting waves with a lot of chop and confusion make you want to get on a board and go out and try it, we have two developer slots open. Otherwise, stay where you are. Thank you.
Thanks today to Lucinda Holt for agreeing to use her presentation on the podcast. You can find this and many other presentations on our website. To find out more about us, visit www.chariotsolutions.com.